The following podcast was recorded at the 2008 CFA Institute Annual Conference in Vancouver, Canada. For other multimedia content, please visit cfawebcasts.org.
Terrific. So I want to talk to you about prediction markets. And in particular, I want to make three big claims in this talk. The first is, something that you've all been schooled in. I call this the greatest swindle in business school, the efficient markets hypothesis. I call it the greatest swindle because we only tell the students about it after they've paid $40,000 a year. The efficient markets hypothesis, as you well know, says it's really darn hard to make money in financial markets. And whenever I tell my students about this, they get somewhat despondent. A key aim of this talk is actually to then turn the lens around and give you the good news that comes out of that. If markets are really efficient, then the price that comes out of any market becomes a real thing of beauty. It becomes incredibly valuable. That price embeds a huge amount of information. I'm going to make that case to you using a bunch of prediction markets, but because it's late in the day and it's better to have a bit more fun, the set of markets we're going to talk about today is going to be sports betting markets. The second claim I want to make, though, is that prediction markets beyond sports betting can help track political risk. And given that this is an election year, I think it's worth emphasizing that political risk, I think, is a key factor driving investment performance. And so I want to make that case using a bunch of recent examples. And finally, at the end, I want to talk a little about why do prediction markets work, and given that, when might they fail? And hopefully behavioral finance can give us a few pointers there. So with that, let's move on to talking about the efficient markets hypothesis. You all know this next slide very well, so it's only because I'm an academic economist I have to repeat it. The efficient markets hypothesis: market prices fully reflect available information. The word available comes in several different flavors. If we're talking about the weak form of the efficient markets hypothesis, we're talking about past prices are fully reflected. If we're talking semi-strong, publicly available information is fully reflected in the price. And, of course, if we're thinking about the strong form of the efficient markets hypothesis, then prices reflect all information. So the important thing here is that the price comes to reflect, summarize, and aggregate a huge amount of information. The unfortunate implication of this, of course, is that excess returns, alpha, profit, the good stuff, becomes unpredictable. I want to make the case, though, that prediction markets do look like they follow many of the sorts of have many of the characteristics you would expect from an efficient market. And so let's begin by having fun. I want to show you, first of all, that prediction markets respond rapidly to news. Any of you who are Chicago Cubs fans will remember Game 6 of the 2003 National League Championship Series very well. This was an amazing game. If the Cubs won this game, they would go on to the World Series. And it was worse than that. The Red Sox were going to meet them in the World Series, and one of the two teams would have to win. That seems very unlikely. One of the innovations that's a lot of fun is that you can now trade stock in whether or not your favorite team is going to win any particular sports game during the game. And so this prediction market from TradeSports pays a dollar if and only if the Cubs win this particular game. As you can see, at the beginning of the game, it looked like the Cubs were about a 75% chance of winning the game. Things were going swimmingly for them, and as they went ahead 3-0 at the top of the eighth, we'd gotten to a 95% chance that the Cubs would, in fact, make it to the World Series. If any of you recall, this is one of the great collapses in sporting history. Fan Steve Bartman reaches over and spoils a loose catch, and the Marlins proceed to hit 8 runs in that inning. And what do you see? The market's responding to this new information absolutely rapidly. Market price is declining from 95 cents down to about 5 cents in a matter of minutes. So these markets seem to respond quickly to news. Are these market prices accurate? For this next chart, what I've done is I've collected data from all 22,000 Major League Baseball games played during the 1990s. And then what I've done is I've taken every game where the market, for instance, gave one team a 33% chance of winning the game. And then I figured out how many of those games did the team, in fact, win. And it turns out whenever the market says you're a 33% chance of winning, you actually win 31% of the time. Whenever the market says you're a 67% chance of winning, you win 65% of the time. Whenever the market says you're a 90% chance of winning, you win 88% of the time. The difference, of course, is how Las Vegas makes money. But the point here is, again, if you want to understand baseball and say something sensible about the likely outcomes of a game, it looks like the betting odds do an incredibly good job at telling you the likely outcomes. Now, that's baseball. Many of us have different favorite sports. Here's NFL football. I recently moved to Philly, and so I've had to become a football fan. In football, you bet differently. What you do is you bet your money against the house's money against a spread. So if the Eagles, a fantastic football team, were playing your favorite team, you might ask me for a 10.5-point head start just to even up the bet. That's what we call the spread. And so the x-axis here shows you the spread for each of these games, and the y-axis shows you the actual winning outcome. And the point that you get here, the regression line has a slope of almost exactly one, is that when the market says that your team is likely to win by 11 points, the team on average wins by around 11 points. And that holds all the way through the distribution. That's football. I'm an equal opportunity sports fan. Let's move on to basketball. Basketball again. You bet against the spread. You can think about the spread as a market-based prediction of the likely outcome of the game. And if my team is forecast by Las Vegas or this particular prediction market to win by 10 points, then on average, again, it looks like we win by 10 points. So that's sports, and that's kind of fun, and that's, you know, at the very least, you know, cocktail conversation, but how does it relate to you and your investing lives? What I want you to do, and this is the whole prediction markets agenda, is to now think about this as a technology. This is a technology you can use to aggregate various opinions about something you care a lot about. Now, in your professional lives, you care about things beyond football, basketball, and so on. Are there other things that you think would be important to value or aggregate information about in your business? Here's an interesting example from a firm called the Hollywood Stock Exchange, where they run prediction markets on the opening weekend box office take of various movies. So essentially they allow people to trade, or in Australia we'd call it bet, on how well each movie will perform. The x-axis shows you the market aggregated forecast. The y-axis shows you the actual opening take. So now we're actually getting toward the realm of socially useful prediction markets. For instance, if you were covering this industry, you might imagine that using these forecasts could be quite useful. And so then the broader agenda, and this is the thing I really want to try and harness your creativity around, is to try and think about other domains where we might use this technology. So I'm an economist. One of the things I care a lot about is forecasting the future of the economy. And so recently, Deutsche Bank, and it's actually now folded, unfortunately, but Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs started a new market. They called it at the time the economic derivatives market, in which people would trade on the future outcomes of particular economic indicators. People could trade on the future path of non-farm payrolls or initial unemployment claims, retail sales, or business confidence. And what this chart shows you is the market aggregated forecast, which is shown as the blue dots. And it also shows you what we used to call the consensus forecast for each of these economic indicators, shown as the red squares. The x-axis is the forecast, the y-axis is the released value. Now, what you've got to do is sort of tilt your head and see which where the blue dots are closer to the 45-degree line than are the red squares, but I can assure you that in each of the four panels of this chart, they are, in fact, on average, better forecasts. So there are, now think about this another way, there are many different views about the economy. There's lots of different ways of finding out those different views. One is we could call our 30 favorite economists and take the median or mean of their forecasts. That's what the old consensus forecast did. Or the other is we could put our 30 favorite economists in a room or mediate it over the internet and have them bet or trade against each other. Let those who are more confident stake more money on their particular outcome and take the market aggregated price as being our forecast. And it turns out that is a more efficient or effective way of aggregating forecasts. So that's my first claim. And the task I want to leave you with is to try and think about ways in which you can creatively harness this technology to forecast things that are even more interesting than opening box office take or the future path of non-farm payrolls. Partly towards that, these markets, prediction markets have been quite extensively used to track political risk. And so I want to show you some of the evidence of how well these markets do in tracking political risk. And I also want to make the other statement here, which is that political risk is, I think, a very, very important valuation factor and something we all need to be thinking about in this election season. So it turns out you can trade on all sorts of things. When I was living in California, there was a really rather bizarre election in which Arnold Schwarzenegger was running for governor. This was not a movie, it was actually an election. And you could trade on whether or not Schwarzenegger would win the governorship. So again, here I'm showing you the time series of a price, of a contract paying $1 or $100 if Arnold wins. And it turns out you could trade this contract on two different exchanges, Trade Sports based in Ireland or the World Sports Exchange based in the Caribbean. So I thought there has to be a profit opportunity here. I set my computer up to look for arbitrage opportunities between the Caribbean and Ireland. And my computer every 3 hours checked these two websites looking for the potential for profits. And at the end of the whole exercise, I can assure you I didn't make a cent, but I learned a very important research lesson. If you look here at this chart, the bid in one location is never above the ask in the other, which is to say these two markets turn out to be very closely linked. The law of one price that we're so used to in other financial markets appears to hold just as much in political prediction markets. How well do these markets do? Here's another very interesting example from the 2004 presidential race. We're in the middle of talking, certainly in the US, a lot of us about who's going to win the Democratic nomination. And it's worth remembering there was just as interesting a nomination fight in 2004. These are data from the Iowa electronic markets in which you could trade on who was going to win the nomination. One of the things that was interesting, actually, is that Howard Dean, who was the favorite through late 2003, in fact, early on was such an outsider candidate, much the way Obama was a year and a half ago, that he, in fact, did not have his own stock. So the green line was for all other candidates. And if you look around about September, October 2003, you can see that the folks in Iowa all of a sudden had to have a stock split, where they split off the rest of the field from Howard Dean, and then you can see the blue line going up, and you can see that Howard Dean was, in fact, a very strong favorite in Iowa, was a very strong favorite to win the nomination through early 2004. Now, you can see exactly where the Iowa caucuses occurred. That was the red line. And, well, we all know what happened in Iowa.
We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
Now, forgive me, because I've always wanted to do this in front of a crowd as well. Yeah! And what do you see? Howard Dean's, first of all, the surprise Dean loss in Iowa in 2004, if you look at the graph, actually started to become evident in prediction markets a couple of days in advance. The other thing is, after the Dean scream, I went to work the next day and I was around the lunch table talking about it with political scientists, and we were doing what academics do, which is we were muttering back and forth, could it possibly matter? Could a candidacy really depend on a scream or a howl? How would the American people react? And I will tell you, like good academics, 3 weeks later we thought we'd finally resolved the issue. The nice thing about political prediction markets is they're a little quicker than we academics. And so traders were responding and making absolutely snap judgments. And what you see is the markets understood immediately just how powerful and important the message was coming out of Iowa. You see Dean's chances plummet immediately, and rising up out of the ashes is John Kerry, who, as we know, went on to win the nomination. And so I think that's an interesting example of how you get a very different, but sometimes powerful, but more to the point, real-time political narrative coming out of these prediction markets. And actually, these markets have a tremendous historic record. This is data from the Iowa electronic markets. This is University of Iowa academics set up a betting or trading market back in 1988, and they've been running political prediction markets ever since then. And so this graph shows you expected vote outcomes on the y-axis and the actual outcome on the x-axis for a couple of hundred markets that those folks had run. I want to draw your attention to the red squares here. The red squares are the US presidential elections. The thing that's really striking about this graph is you can think about trying to predict the winner of the next election. And I can think of roughly two techniques. In one, you set up a phone bank and you call literally thousands of Americans around the country. and you have hundreds of staff employed doing this, and you have absolutely top-notch statisticians trying to put all those numbers together. Let's call that method the Gallup poll. In the other, you set up a computer, and you let people log on and trade to their heart's content, and you just look at whatever price happens to pop out of the market at the end. Well, the former method is incredibly expensive, and it's actually quite accurate. It tends to get US presidential elections right plus or minus about 2 percentage points. What's interesting is through the same period, the latter method, the political prediction market, which requires no phone calls, got these elections right plus or minus, on average, 1.4 percentage points. So it's a major gain in accuracy and a major decline in costs. What about more recent data? In the 2004 election cycle, you could trade on not only which candidate would become president, but who would win the electoral college votes of each state. And so what I'm showing you here is who was the, on the x-axis, what chance Bush was rated by the market to win each state, and on the y-axis, Bush's actual share of the votes. And what you see is every single dot, all 50 states, are in either the northwest or southeast corners. In every single case, the political prediction markets, the favourite, won. 50 out of 50. What about 2004? We see a roughly similar pattern, with one exception, Alaska, and I'm not even sure that's a state. Hey, I'm from Australia. You guys can bag me easily. What about the most recent election cycle? The Democrats winning the Senate was an unexpected event and upset most pundits and certainly many Republicans. But every single Senate race went exactly the way the political prediction markets predicted. So this sounds like a really neat new technology. It sounds very, you know, Web 2.0 and internet and wisdom of crowds and crowdsourcing and all that stuff, right? Well, it actually turns out that betting on politics is as old as politics itself. Two very enterprising economic historians, Coleman Strumpf and Paul Rode, have actually gone back and put together data on how much betting there was on US presidential elections historically. And it's actually really fascinating. Go back and you read the political coverage from the front page of the New York Times, say from the 1916 election, and I guarantee you it will have no commentary whatsoever about the polls. There's a reason for that. Polling hadn't been invented yet. But what there is enormous coverage of literally betting or trading that was occurring on the curb at outside where the American Stock Exchange currently sits. And these were actually really large amounts of money being traded here. There was $37 million being bet per election on average for this period, which turns out to be about $2 being bet per vote. Or alternatively phrased, the amount being bet on these historical elections was equal to about half of total campaign spending. And so we now have, so it turns out if you look through the archives, we have data on the performance of political prediction markets for well over 100 years. And so let me just show you the performance of political prediction markets over the last 100 years. The x-axis shows you the election eve prediction market price, and the y-axis shows you whether the Republicans won the two-party vote. And again, you can see an enormous cluster of dots in the northeast or southwest corners. Now, there are two exceptions, of course, two obvious exceptions. One is 2000, when in fact Republicans are expected to win the election, and they did win the White House, they just did not win the popular vote. And the other exception is 48, which I think is the most famous exception in American political history. This was, of course, when Truman beat Dewey despite expectations. But beyond that, these markets have been incredibly accurate. And so given this, I think this is a wonderful tool, because what this does is it makes all of us political experts. Again, let's think about the efficient markets hypothesis. The efficient markets hypothesis tells us that all available information is now embodied in the market price. Well, you now have access to the market price. You just look it up on a prediction market like Intrade or the Iowa Electronic Markets. What that means is if you want to be a political expert, all you have to do is look up one single price and you're done. You are now a political expert. And the efficient markets hypothesis is stronger than that. You don't need to read the Wall Street Journal, you don't need to read the Washington Post, and you don't need to read the New York Times, because you're a political expert, just like that. And actually, I've started believing this stuff too. And so This election cycle, I'm actually writing political commentary for the Wall Street Journal, in which the only data I'm allowed to use is prediction market data. If the political prediction market actually aggregates all available information, then that's the only thing we should be watching, and we should be neglecting all the other talking heads and commentary that are out there. And that's what I'm currently doing on the journal's website. And so you can actually see the sort of narrative I've been able to tell so far through the 2008 Democratic nomination race. Here you see the price of a security that pays $100 if Obama becomes the Democratic nominee. You can see it was quite unexpected until his very surprising victory at Iowa moved him to become the favorite. Then a dramatic comeback in New Hampshire by Hillary Clinton. The Michigan primary turned out to be no news for anyone. Super Tuesday, good news for Barack. The Potomac primary, more good news for Barack. And then if you recall, Bill Clinton said, it's all over for Hillary unless we win in Ohio and Texas, which she did. And so you see Barack decline slightly. The Pennsylvania primary, if you read the New York Times, you would have read the Pennsylvania primary as having been a clear victory for Clinton. If instead you look at this through the lens of political prediction markets, she won by as much as you would expect her to win by in a state with Pennsylvania's characteristics. And as a result, her chances of winning the nomination didn't change at all. And then you saw a split decision in Indiana and North Carolina last week. So some would claim, well, a victory either way, that's good news for both. But in fact, it turns out political prediction markets think if they're splitting the victories at this point, that's good news for Barack, and you see his stock price climbing dramatically. Let me emphasize again, whether you like politics or read about politics, you now are an expert. So let's talk about some of the ways in which you're quite expert, and these are some of the things you can just casually drop in at dinner parties, around the water cooler, or when making investment picks. Today we have the West Virginia Democratic primary. Let me tell you without a shadow of doubt that Hillary Clinton will win. How do I know this? I looked up the political prediction markets this morning, and these are the prices for a whole bunch of the forthcoming primaries. Clinton will win West Virginia, she will win Kentucky. She will lose Oregon easily, and she'll lose Montana. Do you notice? I can say this confidently despite the fact I'm an Australian and don't actually know what I'm talking about. She's very unlikely to win a majority of superdelegates. Now I sound like a Democratic insider, don't I? And this is the point, so can you. If these prices are efficient, then all of a sudden you've summarized all available political information that's out there. Is Clinton going to stay in the race? Well, there's not a big chance she's going to drop out in May, but I think it's really likely she's going to drop out by the end of June. Actually, I don't. The market does. But again, you now are a political expert. What about the 08 race? Right now, the Democrats are a 61.5% chance to win the White House. They're a 94% chance to hold on to the House and a 92% chance to hold on to the Senate. Are we expecting high turnout? Well, currently there's a 52% chance that turnout will exceed 60%, and so on. And so the key point here is prediction markets provide an excellent way for us, you and I, to track political risk. Let me make the other half of the argument, that I think it's absolutely crucial that you learn how to track political risk, because political risk is a key valuation factor. So as a social scientist, if I wanted to find out whether Democrats or Republicans were good for stocks, what I would want to do is do the same thing a physical scientist would do. I'd want to run a medical trial in which I randomly assign the presidency half the time and find out when it was a randomly assigned Democrat, how stocks performed, and find out when it was a randomly assigned Republican, how stocks performed. Unfortunately, we can't get human subjects approval to run that experiment, but it turns out that that experiment has actually already happened in the US for us. Let me explain. Take election night 2004. I don't know how well you remember that night, but I remember it incredibly well. The blue line here shows you the probability that John Kerry wins the presidency. And here I'm showing you from noon on election day through to 6 a.m. the next day. And so you can see Kerry begins election day at about a 60% chance of becoming president. And then you see what happened was that early exit polls were released suggesting Kerry had won in a landslide. So big, people were predicting he'd win all 50 states. And so the probability of Bush being president declined by 30 percentage points. But here's the thing I love as a social scientist. People's perception of the probability of a Bush presidency declined by 30 percentage points for no reason, randomly. Those exit polls gave me the experiment that I always wanted to analyze. What would happen if we randomly made people think it was more likely that Bush would no longer be president? Well, what happened was the S&P 500 through the same period fell by 0.7 percentage points. So if getting rid of 0.3 of a bush causes stocks to decline by 0.7 percentage points, then we can infer that getting rid of a whole bush would cause stocks to decline by 2.3 percentage points. The world is linear in probabilities. And actually, we have a second wonderful experiment, which is, it turns out, they actually counted the votes in 2004, and the probability of Bush being president rose by 65 percentage points over just a couple of hours, and we know it did so for purely random reasons. Everyone had already voted, and the S&P 500 rose by 1.3 percentage points, suggesting that stocks are worth maybe 2% more under Bush than under Kerry. So I don't know whether this strikes you. I think what you learn from this beauty is in the eye of the ideological beholder. I'm sure the Republicans among us will be reassured that their candidate is good for the stock market, and Democrats will be reassured that the difference between the two is actually rather small. We can also look to other markets as well. Here's the bond market. Here I'm showing you the same. The blue line is again the probability of Bush becoming president. The pink line now is the return on a long bond. And one thing you see clearly is that long bond yields are actually expected to be substantially higher under Bush than under Kerry. So the old view that many of us had that Republicans are more fiscally responsible, it seems that bond markets disagree. But that's actually what's happening at the aggregate level. I think what's even more interesting is if you look at which firms are expected to do well under which candidates. So this is from a paper by Brian Knight, very interesting paper, in which what he does, the red line here shows you Bush's chances of winning. This now was the 2000 election, 2004. And the blue line, what he does is he constructs a John Kerry stock portfolio and a George Bush stock portfolio. So the George Bush stock portfolio has like big oil, big tobacco, big pharma, all the industries with the word big in it. The Kerry portfolio has got things like environmentally friendly manufacturing, generic pharmaceuticals, so on. And what you see is, so the blue line shows you the difference in the returns on these two portfolios, and you see the difference in the returns on these two portfolios is really large, and it's really large depending on who it is who's expected to get elected. What about other forms of political risk? This is from a paper that I wrote actually in 2002. We wrote this before the US went to war in Iraq. The red line here shows you the probability. There was a trade sports security that was equal to $100, was worth $100 if and only if Saddam Hussein was no longer the leader of Iraq by June 2003. So you can think about this as moving around as it became more and less likely that the US would go to war. It was, it started quite likely, and then through Thanksgiving in 2002 it became less likely, and ultimately, of course, we did go to war. The blue line shows you the S&P 500. What you should see is that the two are clearly negatively correlated. This is markets saying, with a level of clarity that I think economic talking heads lacked, that going into Iraq was going to be bad for the US economy. And in fact, if you look at the magnitudes here, it suggests the difference between peace and war was maybe worth as much as 15 percentage points for US stocks. So this is the sense in which, again, I want to claim that what we learn from this is that political risk is a key factor for any investment valuations. So what are the lessons I learned from this particular graph? These poor chaps over in Iraq, the two of them, one talking to the other, they've just seen the graph I just showed you, and one says, how do you stay so calm about the stock market? And the reason he's saying this, of course, is because the stock market is aggregating people's views on how well things will or will not go in Iraq. So now we have this technology. You are now an expert about lots of things. You're an expert about the likely effects of war in Iraq, about various political events, but we can take this, and again, this is the thing I want to reinforce. What this is waiting for now is your creativity to find other ways that we can deploy this technology to better forecast our future. Here are some interesting forecasts that you can get right now from intrade.com. The probability that we have bird flu in the US before the end of 2008 is 22%. The probability that Osama is captured or neutralized is 16%. The probability of a U.S. or Israel airstrike against Iran is 22%. Of military action against North Korea is 8%. Of Chinese military action against Taiwan is 10%. Of an Israel-Palestine peace treaty, 26%. Now for some good news. Of Bush being impeached, 3.5%. Of a gas tax holiday, 7.5%. Of Mugabe leaving as the Zimbabwe president, 65%. And that the average global temperature in 2008 will be among the five warmest years on record, 27%. I don't want to bum you out about all the things we should worry about in our world, but this list should sort of bum you out. The point, though, is no longer are these qualitative things that are hard to value. They're now quantifiable. And they're now quantifiable, and that information now has been aggregated in a really useful way for you. So the third claim I want to make is to ask why do prediction markets work and what might happen when they fail? Why do they work? I think the first thing is you can think about incentives for truthful revelation. When it comes to large political issues, like many of those I just told you about, bird flu, war, and so on, talking heads on TV have large political incentives to misrepresent the truth. And this may even be true of economic forecasts as well. The nice thing about prediction markets is people are putting their money where their mouth is. And when you put your money where your mouth is, it tends to help you tell the truth. The other, as you all know from working in various financial markets, is when you can make money by having a better view or better information than the next guy, that provides an enormous incentive for you to go out and actually discover that information. Now, I should add that the difficult thing that we've got to add into the mix here is human behavior. And for those of you who followed what we're learning from behavioral finance, sometimes human behavior can get in the way of markets being as efficient as we might like them to be. So let me actually just speak very quickly, not so about where and when I think these markets will be useful. Here is an example of a market that I think was a colossal failure. The market was asked, will weapons of mass destruction be discovered in Iraq by the end of May 2003, June 2003, July 2003, September 2003? And you can see, in early 2003, these markets were just as fooled as the rest of us in thinking there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. This shouldn't surprise any of us. If there's no useful information out there to be aggregated, it probably isn't a surprise that the market doesn't do a very good job in aggregating it. So markets aren't magic. All they are is ways of aggregating available information. Now, it could be that you're out there in Iraq and, you know, you're living in your family home and you could go downstairs and inspect your basement, come back upstairs and declare, well, no weapons of mass destruction in my basement. But that's not really enough information that you want to go and trade on that information, is it? And as a result, that information is unlikely to be aggregated. And so we shouldn't expect markets to be all-seeing or all-knowing if market participants are neither all-seeing nor all-knowing. I promised to say a little about the fact, or the problem, that the people who trade in prediction markets are people, and people make mistakes. One of the best documented mistakes that people make in markets is we're really bad at telling the difference between a small probability and a tiny probability. So what this shows you, what this chart shows you, is I have data from all 5 million horse race starts that occurred in the United States in the 1990s. And what I've done is, for each level of odds, I've calculated the rate of return, for instance, if you bet on every horse that was at odds of 2-1, or the rate of return for betting on every horse at odds of 100-1, and so on. The first thing you'll see is betting on horses is a mug's game. The rate of return is uniformly negative here. But the other thing that you'll see is that typically you're going to earn a negative rate of return of maybe 15%. Lose 15 cents for every dollar you bet, and that's not so bad if you're having a day out at the track with friends. But if you insist on betting on those horses at odds of 100-1, your rate of return plummets to about 65 or minus 70%. This is an alternative way of saying this is people consistently overbet long shots. We are all terrible at telling the difference between a 1 in 100 chance and these horses at 100-1 actually instead turn out to be a 1 in 500 chance. And so markets do a very good job, very bad job at distinguishing between small and tiny risks. So be mistrustful of some of those. Let me tell you another problem that one of the graphs I showed you earlier, I boasted about this. I said markets got every state right when trying to predict who would win the presidential election by state, and they only got this one state wrong in trying to predict the Senate in 2004. That's not necessarily good news, though. If the market says that something's an 80% chance of happening, it should happen 4 times out of 5, not 5 times out of 5. And what we saw was it's more likely to occur 5 times out of 5. This, again, I think is another manifestation of the same problem, that people are overrating the chances of long shots or small probabilities. Another problem in markets is we all bring our preconceived ideas to markets. I want you to think for a moment. Close your eyes and think about picture a great baseball player. Picture that person in your head. I'm going to take a guess at what that person looks like. I'm guessing they're about 6 foot, male, white, and probably overweight. Importantly, very few of us will have pictured a black athlete. It's not our mental representation of a great baseball player. Babe Ruth is our mental representation of a great baseball player. And what the representativeness heuristic leads us to do is to look at a great black baseball player and maybe underestimate their ability because they don't look like what we think a great baseball player should look like. If my theory is true, then markets should systematically undervalue the chances of predominantly black baseball teams winning games. In which case, maybe we should start a fund where we bet on predominantly black baseball teams. Well, let me show you some data. The far left bar shows you what happens when I bet on teams that have seven or more white players. The average rate of return per $1 bet is about 92 cents. But as I move across this graph, I keep dropping white players out of the graph and bringing in more of these people who don't fit my representation of a great baseball player. My rate of return, in fact, rises in violation of the efficient markets hypothesis. And so this is just one sense in which I think that behavioral finance tells us ways in which markets do make mistakes and therefore occasions in which we may not want to trust prediction markets. Let's try the experiment one more time, but now a little bit closer to home. I want you to think about a great CEO, a CEO you really admire, someone whose stock you would love to buy. My bet is you chose a guy about 6'4", white, wearing a pinstripe suit, and it was a bloke. It was a male, right? Which means that female CEOs don't fit your mental representation of great CEOs. In which case, if you look at a female-headed firm, you may systematically have a tendency to undervalue those firms. So what I did is I looked at, this is a complicated graph, and I apologize. I'm still trying to find the right way of describing this, but it's a really cool finding. I took all the earnings announcements that have occurred in the U.S. over the last decade, and then I organized them by the size of the earnings surprise that occurred. And because women are about 1% of all CEOs, they're about 1% of all earnings announcements. But if I look at the largest positive earnings surprises, women are dramatically overrepresented. And when I look at the largest negative earnings surprises, women are dramatically underrepresented, telling us that market participants systematically underestimate the value of female-headed firms. And what I haven't shown you on this slide, but is finding it's work in progress, and so I look forward to talking more about it, is we can actually go and look at which analysts are most surprised. And it turns out that female CEOs have a tremendous propensity to surprise male analysts. Let me bring this talk back full circle. I started off making three claims, so I want to end with three conclusions. The first is this lesson from the efficient markets hypothesis. It's not the bad news you were taught in business school. If the efficient markets hypothesis is true, sure, it's hard to make money, but the flip side of this is prices become this incredibly beautiful and incredibly useful summary statistic of available information out there, and so prediction markets can help us aggregate that. The second, therefore, is prediction market prices can be really useful inputs into your decision-making in financial, managerial, even public policy domains. But I don't want to be one of these market nuts who tells you that markets are always and everywhere efficient. They're not. Markets suffer the same foibles that we do, and we think that there, and I think there are lessons from behavioral finance that will tell us when and where we might want to rely on markets and when we might want to rely on other things. Let me just conclude really with what I hope you get from this. One is that we can use prediction markets to aggregate forecasts of things like political risk. And if you're not thinking hard enough about political risk in your job right now, I think the next year is going to force you to do so. So you're now, this can be a way of you becoming very easily and cheaply a political expert. But then actually think about this as a tool, again, for information aggregation within your own firms. What is it that you need information about? What is it you would like to aggregate information from your fellow co-workers and your staff that's not currently being done very well? My guess is that you actually do currently use an information aggregation mechanism in your work. It's this thing called a staff meeting, right? And a whole bunch of people get in the room and the boss says, what do you think about this particular issue? Well, the loud, obnoxious guy begins a 20-minute speech. Then the brown noser says, whatever you think, boss. And then probably the really scientific, studious person is too shy to speak up, or women may speak less in meetings and these sorts of things. So the information act, the ways in which we are aggregating information within our firms and our everyday work life is, I think, by any measure, terrible. And so potentially prediction markets provide you with another way that doesn't have some of those problems. So let me stop there.
Thank you very much. Since I'm essentially swimming here in questions, I'm going to try to aggregate a number of these questions into pools that I think capture what some of the primary issues to our audience are. I hope I catch your question in that attempt. We've actually gotten a number of questions that really relate to the potential for insider trading knowledge, that ability to distort the prediction markets and even manipulate it in effect if you have enough money.
Great question. I think there's actually two issues there. One is insiders and the other is manipulation. So insiders, so we're used to in financial markets thinking about insiders as bad guys. You know, they're the ones who short orange juice futures at the wrong time in, I forget that movie. Insiders bring information. And so in some sense, given what we're after here is not fair markets, what we're after is predictive markets. We're trying to make our markets as useful as possible. Having insiders can be an incredibly good thing. And so the way you think about insiders in prediction markets, I think, should be very different. In some sense, we want to welcome them. Now, I don't want to welcome them too far. For instance, I could offer you a bet right now. Let me offer you a bet. Are you willing to bet me $100? I'm willing to bet you $100 that I'm wearing red underwear today. Now, red is a very unusual color for men to wear, but I'm going to offer you an even money bet. Do you want to take that bet?
No.
Right. So what we just saw is that by the extent of the inside information... I won't tell you who would have won. The inside information there, the information asymmetry between the two of us there was so great, you weren't willing to trade with me. And that caused the market to completely disappear. And so that's something we have to be really careful of within organizations. The second question that came up was manipulation. If you could just bring up slide 46, that might be helpful. Let me just summarize that, though. There have been many attempts to manipulate prediction market prices. Now, there was this really wonderful attempt a few years ago. Pat Buchanan was running for the Republican nomination. And so he encouraged his supporters to buy Pat Buchanan stock. Now, you already know I don't know a lot about politics. I know one thing. Pat Buchanan is never becoming president. So if someone says to you, I'm willing to buy stock in Pat Buchanan, what's your reaction? I'm willing to sell. And so it's that free entry force, the supply response, that ultimately meant that Pat Buchanan's supporters couldn't affect the price for more than a couple of hours. And so we do sometimes see manipulation attempts, but every single one that I'm aware of has failed. Now, there's an important caveat to that sentence. I said every single one I'm aware of. The ones that I'm not aware of may be the ones that were successful.
Great. I'm going to pick one of these questions, but there are a few in the same line. It says, to what degree have you studied or do you believe widespread access and use of prediction markets influence subsequent behavior, in a sense, persistence momentum?
Yeah. So I've staked some amount of my academic career on prediction markets, and, you know, I enjoy coming to conferences and talking to you guys about them. I don't have a big enough ego to think anyone's actually listening. So I think at this point in the political cycle, this is still relatively a fringe phenomenon. The number of words devoted by the press to prediction markets relative to those devoted to polls is sufficiently small. I don't think we need to worry about that. Now, all of that said, if we go back to 1916, as I mentioned, there was no polls. And so the equivalent of Spin Alley back in the 1916 election was, in fact, Tammany Hall had a large war chest that they would run down to the curb and scream out loud, "We're betting Democrat, we're betting Democrat," in an attempt to influence the market. And so the same researchers who have uncovered those data assure me that both sides did in fact try very hard to influence the prices and hope that that would create some political dynamic after that, but ultimately they weren't very successful.
Okay, great. So in a sense, that begs a question that came up too. What about prediction markets with real money versus play money?
Yeah, so I'm an economist, and I would lose my union card if I didn't say real money always makes a difference. And I think one of the important things about prediction markets is they do ask you to put your money where your mouth is. Now, that said, I made this statement once to a Frenchman who runs a prediction markets company, and his company uses play money. And so he said to me, "I'm willing to bet you, Justin, here we bet a bottle of wine, that my play money market does as well as your real money market." And so we set up a competition where his play money market, newsfutures.com, would predict the winner of each Saturday's football games. I don't know why we chose football, but we chose football. And my real money market, I use tradesports.com, would also try and predict the winner of each Saturday's football games. And it turns out, by the end of the season, the two had amassed prediction records that were just about as good as each other. So it turns out, despite my guess that money makes a big difference, it turns out not to. So let me give you two explanations for this. One is, first of all, prediction markets are doing something really useful that the polls don't do. Prediction markets ask the right question. They say, who do you think is going to win? That's different than saying, who would you like to win, or who do you plan to vote for? The second is to try and think about the different influence each of us has in markets. So take U.S. equity markets. Warren Buffett has a much bigger influence on U.S. equity markets than I do. We probably think that's a good thing and it makes the market more efficient. It also turns out that Paris Hilton has a much bigger influence on U.S. equity markets than I do. And we may not think that makes the market more efficient. Now, the beautiful thing about a play money prediction market is the only way to get rich in a play money prediction market is by having been Warren Buffett. There's no such thing as a Paris Hilton in a play money prediction market because you can't inherit the wealth. So I think it turns out to be a surprisingly close draw.
Really? Interesting. A couple of the charts you were showing showed some of the prediction markets used for economic analysis, and you made the comment that they don't have those anymore.
Yeah.
What happened, and why aren't we using those instead of economists for our predictions?
Yeah, we should get rid of all those economists. It turns out, so which markets exist and don't exist turns out to be a function of which markets are profitable to run for those who run the market. And so it turns out that Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank were actually charging, to my eye, unbelievably high fees. And when you charge high fees, no one likes to trade. And so it turned out not to be a profitable business for them to be in. That's a very different statement than the claim that I want to make, which is if such a market existed, many of us would find it valuable. And so I am currently, there are a bunch of governments around the world right now that are thinking about running these within their bureaucracies. So rather than have all the economic forecasters get together in a room, give everyone $100 and let them bet against each other. And so we may see these things arise within organizations more than between organizations.
Interesting. There are a number of questions about timing. How far in advance do prediction markets work? Can you use it to, say, think of what GE's price is going to be 5 years from now? Or some of the prediction markets you've used actually, they come into very short time frames.
Yeah. So I want to make two statements there. One, the closer we get to any event, the more easy it is to predict. That's true whether you're a market, whether you're a forecaster, whether you're whatever the heck. And the other is, at any given horizon, prediction markets seem to do better than the alternative. So right now, you might think that the prediction markets on the 08 race, which are 60-40, 60% likely it's a Democrat, 40% a Republican, that's pretty wishy-washy. But it's pretty wishy-washy because we don't actually know much about what that race is going to look like. And so it may be that a lot of the value of markets this far out is not that they tell you who's going to win, but they're a really good way of measuring our ignorance. So if someone's in a bar tonight and they say, "I guarantee you I'm a political expert, it'll definitely be a Democrat in the White House," that guy's just being overconfident. The best aggregation of available information says it's a 60% chance, and if you're more confident than that, you're probably the fool.
Here's one. It's a little bit long, but I'll read it. Your point about market prices being correct is well taken. However, given your example of the Dean Carey reversal and not discounting the probability of these tails events, in other words, the current probability of Obama being elected may be correct, but it does not preclude it from a tail event. Is that correct? So again, you know, what's, I guess, the question, which there are a few others, is the impact of tail events on some of these prediction markets.
Yeah, so every time an event happens like the Dean reversal, you know, Dean went from 80 to zero, I get all these calls from friends, Justin, aren't you worried? Prediction markets are wrong. Same thing happened after the New Hampshire primary. The New Hampshire primary market said that it was only a 7% chance Obama would win. Obama won. There's a thing about 7% probabilities we've all got to remember. They happen 7 times out of every 100. If they happen less than that, we're in trouble, and if they happen more than that, we're in trouble. So if I think about what happened to Howard Dean, Howard Dean was an 80% chance at that point in the race. I think that's the best possible assessment. 4 times out of 5, he goes on and becomes the triumphant candidate, and 1 time, something crazy like a Dean scream happens, and he falls off the face of the earth. And the thing about 1 in 5 chances is they happen sometimes. So that's the main claim that I would make. The second is the one I tried to give something of a warning about, which is I think these markets are not well calibrated over very small probabilities. So when markets are telling you stuff is, you know, between a 10 and a 90% chance, I tend to take that as being a pretty good assessment of a probability. When they're telling you it's a 5% chance, I think we're all pretty terrible at telling the difference between 5, 2, and 1.
here's a one. How do you find prediction markets? I mean, yeah, how do you go about finding prediction markets?
People call me and they say, look at my market.
Really?
That may not be so helpful. let me just tell you some of the ones that I like to watch. I want to be upfront, I have conflicts of interest. I advise many of these companies, but I will tell you those I do as well as don't advise. Intrade.com is one that has a lot of the data I just showed you. They have really beautiful U.S. political coverage, probably the best U.S. political coverage. Another related one that I think is excellent is Betfair.com. They have a lot more British political coverage. The Iowa electronic markets are predominantly political, and so I think has a narrower range than the others. So things like Intrade also will have things like, you know, the next Supreme Court appointment, all sorts of, you know, delightful gossip things. I used to have a boss in Australia. Water cooler conversation in Australia is very macho, and we always talk about sports. And so she wanted to be a part of all of that. And so for her, the most important forecast she wanted me to get was not, you know, who's going to be president, but who's going to win the football game. So my job on a Thursday was to call the local bookie and get the odds on all the games. Once she knew the odds, she could strut to the water cooler with absolute confidence and say, I'm certain that this team will win. And she'd be right all the time, which would just blow the guys away. And so there's literally infinite sports books online that will allow those of you who want to become instant sports experts to cheat a little around the water cooler.
How do option and derivative markets do as a proxy for as prediction markets?
Yeah, great question. I want to broaden the question a little. I think we're surrounded by prediction markets, and we're also surrounded by a poverty of terminology. When I began my talk, I started off by talking about betting on football and basketball. So that's like, you know, one end of the spectrum, clearly betting. And then there's this other end, which, as I understand it, this one, by the way, I'm told is unethical and unbecoming. At the other end, we have, you know, options and derivatives markets, whereas I understand that people bet, instead of on, you know, what a football team will do, they bet on what Ben Bernanke will do. But I'm told that's called options. Both are purchasing state contingent claims. You're purchasing a contract that will be worth a lot if something happens and not much if it doesn't happen. And so I think some of the most interesting prediction markets are both sports betting markets and options markets as well. And if you think about equity markets and if you think about futures markets, a futures market is simply a prediction market on the future path. So there's a deep sense in which I'm not talking about anything new here. The only thing that's new here is what you use these markets for. So when we talk about the value of options and derivatives markets, we always talk about their value in terms of the fact that they help us shuffle risk around. So you get to bear risk and I don't, and things like that. I think the value of a lot of markets comes not from the rejiggering of who holds risk, but instead that the price itself becomes incredibly valuable to people in how they then go and conduct the rest of their operations and the rest of their lives.
How much volume is required for the prediction markets to really be seen as accurate?
It's a terrific question. First of all, I admitted already to having been surprised by how well play money prediction markets do. And so if I get my math right, high volume times zero price turns out to be a $0 volume. And so they still do very well despite the fact they have $0 volume. One of the things I've been surprised by time and again, and this is just an intuitive answer, not a particularly scientific one, is these markets do surprisingly well with even very small numbers of participants. And so within corporations, I've seen people maybe, you know, get a dozen people to trade in a market on something of interest to that corporation. And they do pretty well. And again, I think the right metric here, by the way, is not is the forecast accurate. It's is it more accurate than what I would have done otherwise? And, you know, if you got a dozen of us to even just bet on how many people are in this room, my guess is that's going to yield a better forecast than what CFA was going to rely on otherwise. And so small numbers can actually, I think, be surprisingly useful.
Great. So is there a chance that we could have prediction markets on terrorist events?
Not in the United States in the foreseeable future. So there's an element of mischief to that question. I think it's probably now 4 or 5 years ago, the Department of Defense, DARPA, had funded a group to run prediction markets on geopolitical events. And if you follow the logic that we've been talking about so far, the logic's impeccable that if this can help us predict economics and it can help us predict sports and it can help us predict movies, why can't it help us predict trouble overseas? Ultimately, Senators Wyden and Dorgan got hold of this, misrepresented the whole project, I think, publicly, but called it a terrorism betting market and said it was morally disgusting and the whole exercise was shut down. I think there's definitely moral issues there. It turns out, I just discovered the other day, it turns out there's a prediction market on whether I'm going to die this year. No, there is. It's called life insurance. And so I think a lot of the moral acceptability of these things really depends on the framing. And the framing of terrorism future sounds really awful. The other major concern that was raised at the time was if you set up a terrorism prediction market, by jingo, don't you create temptation for the terrorists, right? You could bet that there's going to be an attack this week and then, by jingo, all of a sudden, suicide bombing does make sense after all. This strikes me as problematic reasoning. If I were going to commit a major terrorist event, I'm being filmed, aren't I? If I were going to commit a major terrorism event, I would not bet in a Department of Defense prediction market. But I would short United Airlines options like crazy. And so the point is, many of our the serious point here is all of our important geopolitical risks are already being traded by many people. They're just not being traded in a way that makes the information that's being revealed to the market transparent to policymakers. And so the whole idea of terrorism futures is actually just to make that information. Why are people shorting United right now? Is it because of high gas prices or because of a terrorist event? If we had a prediction market as to whether there were a terrorist event, it would help us sort out which of the two was driving things and actually make that information more transparent to policymakers.
Great. Well, as we come to the end of the hour, I'm just going to follow up with one question, and that is if female CEOs are known for earning surprises, are we underestimating Hillary Clinton's ability to make a comeback? And along that same line, if it's true about black baseball players doing better, are we underestimating Obama's chance of becoming president?
Now you're bumming me out. You're telling me it's bad news for white men, huh? It's possible. I mean, these biases are pervasive, and we may be underestimating any of these guys, for sure.
Great. Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking Dr. Wolfers.
Copyright 2008, CFA Institute. No part may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, recording, or otherwise, without the express prior written permission of CFA Institute. This program is designed to give accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is distributed with the understanding that CFA Institute is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, investment, or other expert advice. If legal advice or other expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.